The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. And I spent today at our retreat. We're teaching a one-week retreat being held at Hidden Villa, so I was there during the day today, and it was great to be there on retreat. Kind of to be on retreat clarifies things. It's very nice. So in the Zen tradition, in some corners of the Zen tradition, there's a saying that goes something like, delusion is enlightenment. And of course, they don't mean that delusion is enlightenment, just like that. What they mean is that enlightenment is found in the delusion. So the Zen Master Dogen said, deluded people are deluded about enlightenment. Enlightened people are enlightened about delusion. There's something about, it's a way of viewing or engaging or practicing with delusion, with attachment, with suffering, with the difficulties of our life, that turn those difficulties into the path of practice. And it's quite a beautiful idea, turning it into the path. It's kind of like the path doesn't exist. The Buddhist path doesn't really exist until we make it. I could talk about it until my face turns blue, and my talking about it doesn't make it exist. It only exists if you choose to walk that path. And in your walking, you make the path. But it isn't just the walking that makes the path. It's that in order to make the path, you have to clear the obstructions. The path is overgrown with bushes and weeds and branches. And so you have to kind of encounter those obstacles. And you have to somehow relate to those obstacles that to find a way, a path through them or around them or with them or you know, something. And so the obstacles that we have are not really seen as obstacles. Another kind of Zen kind of thing. Obstacles are not obstacles. Obstacles, they're obstacles in a sense, but they're not obstacles if we have it, if we turn them into the path, if we understand them as the locus of our practice, of the mindfulness practice, the Buddhist practice, the practice of awakening. If you think that awakening or the path is going to be found when you no longer have any obstacles, then you'll be looking beyond into some imaginary future. But if you see that the very problems you have can be made into the path, then the problems are not to be looked beyond. The problems are to be penetrated, to be understood, to be seen. So this is a different perspective than most people have with their difficulties and their problems and their struggles in their life. And the challenge, I think, of a mature Buddhist practice is when you have difficulties of whatever kind, is to look at them in such a way that you see the possibility of practicing in them. So what does it mean to practice with our difficulties? And there's a variety of things that it means. One thing it means is that you study them, get to know them better, and you get to understand yourself in the process. So what is it that you're attached to? What is it that drives you? What is it if you're caught up in anger a lot or discouragement a lot or if you are full of some kind of particular resentment? So that could be kind of simmering and all these things can be going along. When you sit down to meditate, those things are spinning your mind out. It's hard to stay present. So you, rather than kind of avoid them, rather than trying to push them away or let go of them to get back to the real practice, you turn around and say, what is going on here? What is this stuff about? And you look right at it. In the process, you might learn something about yourself. And you might learn, for example, that if you're angry, maybe, the anger has its genesis not in what someone did to you, but really has its source in the fact that you had a particular self-image of who you thought you should be. And that self-image was somehow challenged in the situation. And it was a threatened self-image that generated all this energy of anger. So you turn your look at it and you say, oh, that's what's going on. Or there are challenges that occur that make it hard for us to stay present for the challenges. And so, okay, so the practice, what does it mean to be present? How do I stay present in these challenges, whatever they might be? And in staying present, we are cultivating and developing the inner qualities that are part of the path. So in staying present for a challenge rather than running away from it, we're developing patience, we're developing courage, we're developing focus, concentration, mindfulness, we're hopefully developing some wisdom, perhaps we're developing other qualities, maybe a certain degree of healthy acceptance or forgiveness or equanimity in relationship to what's going on. Perhaps in order to stay present, we have to cultivate loving kindness or compassion. And so we kind of arouse in ourselves certain qualities that need to be developed that are being developed become the path. But then there's another aspect of how to turn our difficulties or challenges into the path. And that is how we view them, how we relate to them. And now if you look at some difficulty and say, oh, poor me. Someone help me. There's no path in that. You know, in a million years you won't find the path in saying, oh, poor me, someone help me. But what is it, how would you look at your challenges, your difficulties, which are real? Life is full of amazing challenges. It breaks my heart sometimes, the challenges that we have to face. But how can we view them? How can we be present for them in such a way that awakening even is found there? And one of the ways is to begin to understand the ways in which we create, ways we get entangled unnecessarily with the challenges. So one way we get unnecessarily entangled with it is if we relate the challenge to some kind of self-identity we're trying to uphold. So if someone is angry with you, it might be an uncomfortable situation, but the real struggle is that your self-identity is challenged. Your idea that you're a kind, loving person is somehow being challenged because this person is really pissed off at some of your behavior. They didn't think you were kind and loving. And so your self-image, you need to be a kind person, is somehow being challenged and upset. And so the person's anger towards you is unnecessarily entangled by trying to uphold some idea of who you think you need to be. And there's an infinite number of ways in which we hold on to some concept of who we have to be that somehow gets entangled with it. Or there might be stories that we add to the difficulty. So it might be that we have stories of this means that, and we fill in the blank. This means that, and then in the future, all kinds of things, or terrible things are going to happen. An example I like to give, because it's, you know, it's maybe common enough experience, is the entanglements you might have around waking up in the middle of the night and not being able to go back to sleep. So, that's happened to me. And one of the interesting things to notice in that situation is if I put aside all my projections into the next day, what not getting enough sleep means, generally, when I can't sleep in the middle of the night, I'm actually really comfortable. I'm warm in bed. I'm relaxed. So sometimes I'm nicely alert. I wish I was that alert when I meditated. You know, I'm nicely alert. No one's wanting anything from me at all. You know, the kids are asleep. What else could I want? And so everything's going, you know, everything's great in and of itself in the moment. But, oh, tomorrow, I'm going to drag so much. Tomorrow, it's going to be so hard to have those conversations with those people. Tomorrow, I won't be able to get my things done. Tomorrow, it's going to be a drag. And so some of the suffering, or a lot of the suffering that I've noticed in myself around not getting sleep in the middle of the night has to do with is anticipatory suffering. Oh, that hit a nerve. Anticipatory suffering. I guess some of you know that too. So that's the story. I'm caught up in the stories of the future. And sometimes they turn out true, the stories, but sometimes they don't. But still, it's a story we tell ourselves. So is it possible to see it as a story and separate out the event from the story so it's not entangled? So we pull ourselves away a little bit and say healthy pulling away or separating these things and just be with the thing in and of itself. So to see an event independent of some kind of artificial self-concept, which most people have, they operate on, to see the event independent of the variety of stories we build and add to it, which may or may not turn out to be the way they are, and then to pull ourselves away enough from the entanglement to be present for the event until the sense of presence is stronger than the sense of having a problem. To be present enough for the event until the sense of presence is stronger than the sense of the problem. And hopefully some of you have had the experience sometimes in your life of some kind of high quality presence. Presence meaning you're really awake, clear, here, you're really here in a full way. You're taking in what's going on, you're sensitive, you're registering your environment, yourself. You feel very alive, very vibrant, very very present, sense of presence. Or perhaps if you haven't felt it yourself, you felt it in someone else who was really present for you. And you felt there was a real, when the person came into your life, came into you, there was almost a sense of presence in that person. And that presence, you know, was really present for you, and you really felt how great it was that someone was really present for you. Not only were you aware of the person's personality, what they were saying, what they could do for you or not do for you, a variety of things you might know. But what was most palpable was their kind of clear presence, crisp presence that was palpable in itself, independent of who the person was and stuff, you know, conventionally. So that can happen for ourselves too, where our sense of presence becomes stronger. Or to say it in a little bit more traditional mindfulness ways, that the sense of knowing becomes independent of what is known. And generally, our knowing is entangled with what it knows. Or we entangle, we lock together the knowing and the known. So we know something, you know, we want it. So, for example, there could be, you know, you could leave here today and your tires in your car could be flat. It could happen, right? It's kind of a drag, it's nighttime. What are you going to do now? So immediately, you can get entangled with that event. It could be your self-identity. You parked right in front here. Everyone who walks out goes out and sees that your tires are flat. And you see you're standing in front of there, and they get to see what kind of car you drive. And so and so and so. And it's, you know, the Buddhists are seeing, like, you know, who I really am now. This is really embarrassing. Maybe. You know, or it could be some other thing. You know, but, you know, the sense of, you know, all these people are seeing me now, and like the whole story about self arises around this. And that's an entangled thing. Or it could be that there's stories now. Oh, no, this nighttime, what do? It's a drag. You know, can I trust the AAA guy who comes to take care of it? And then it's a woman who comes. You know, you have the story of what it's supposed to, you know, what it's supposed to be like. And so it's, you know, and stories sometimes are good predictions, and sometimes you have to take them into account. But we can also hold a story really tight and suffer more. The third option is that rather than getting entangled and caught up in the drama and the soap opera of a flat tire, there's a real strong sense of being present being here, content, full, awake, satisfied, in a kind of way, not needing anything. A healthy kind of way of not needing anything. And you go out there and you see that, and you say, wow, look at that. And you don't allow that event to diminish the sense of presence or mindfulness or clarity or real knowingness that's here. You don't let it diminish you. And it's so easy to let these kinds of things diminish us. Poor me, and all that. So part of the function of mindfulness practice is to start being mindfulness to what is, to understand what it is, to understand better what's going on, our relationship to what's going on. But it's part of that. Another function of mindfulness practice is to strengthen that capacity of mindfulness until mindfulness becomes a force in its own right, a power. And that power becomes stronger than the gravitational force of attachment, of clinging, of fear, of anger, and all these things. So the power, the strength of mindfulness is stronger than the pull of our attachments, of our clinging. So that our awareness, our presence, can abide independent or free of attachments, of clinging. It's a tall order, not so easy to do, but that's kind of what we're trying to do here. And in small ways, maybe you can do it. And to begin experimenting, where are the small ways where you can know something and not be entangled with it? Allow it to be. Find yourself independent of it, free of it. So if you can do that, so you see a difficulty arise. Say you're sitting in meditation and some strong feelings arise that make it hard for you to be present for your breath. So some people might struggle with the breath, try to avoid the strong feelings. Some people might feel kind of get entangled with the strong feelings and, oh, this is terrible, you know, I'm having a hard time, poor me, this and that. But what is it like to turn towards it and really say, here I am, well, here's presence. I'm going to be really present for this so that my sense of presence is stronger than the pull of entanglement, the pull of kind of making stories and identity and all these issues around something which maybe is much simpler in and of itself. So it requires looking at the situation and seeing it, knowing it, letting it register. Oh, this is really happening. You can't deny. This kind of freedom doesn't happen by denying anything. It doesn't happen by being kind of vague and kind of it's everything's okay kind of attitude. It's like, oh, this is really happening. And now that I really see that it's happening, let me really register it. Let me take it and maybe really acknowledge it. And then that strength of acknowledgement, we're developing a strength of presence which hopefully is stronger than that pull into it, being lost in it. Does that make sense? So every little moment of being mindful, as you open a door, you're mindful of opening the door perhaps, as you turn on the car engine, you kind of be really present for that. Maybe if you drive your car, you're more interested in being mindful and present than you are talking on the phone or the radio, listening to the radio or fantasizing or rehearsing conversations. You're more interested in turning, okay, here I am. And, you know, some simple things as turning on the car engine, driving, opening a door, drinking a cup of tea, walking down the sidewalk. This is not like spiritual rocket science. You know, it's not like you'd have to kind of go to advanced, you know, spiritual training school or get a PhD in Buddhism at Stanford or anything like that. To, you know, be present as you walk down the sidewalk. But something as simple as that, there can be all these arguments in our mind, all these kind of implicit or kind of things that are stronger and seem much more important and compelling than the very simple act of being present as you walk down the sidewalk. I have to figure out my shopping list. I have to fix this relationship. I have to figure out what's for dinner. I have to, you know, there's a whole series of things the mind might be caught up in. And then if you try to be present for the walking, then the lawyers in the mind will come in and say, this is really silly. You know, there's really important things to do in this life. Just walking down the street and paying attention to walking, and you know, that's not going to get you anywhere. There's no financial value. And so there's, you know, the mind kind of has this, you know, it's hard for the mind to make that switch, that shift. But once the shift begins to be made, with time, you'll probably find that the thing that is priceless, much more valuable than any money, is the luminous clarity, or the open clarity of a presence which is stronger than what it's present for. So it's not entangled. And the analogy that I like these days for this kind of clarity of kind of presence, independent presence, doesn't, you know, is what the view looks like here on the peninsula when the air is crystal clear. There's no haze, no smog, and you can see right across to the East Bay Hills. And it's like, you know, you kind of, oh, I didn't realize there were hills over there. And it's so clear, and it's so refreshing, but there's kind of nothing there, right? Because of the absence of the smog and the haze, which makes it so clear. So that sense of presence can have that kind of sense of clarity. Isn't that nice? So, that's my thoughts for today. Turning your very difficulties into the path. And it can be all kinds of things. It can be physical pain. It can be headaches. It can be emotional difficulties. It can be interpersonal struggles and difficulties. It can be powerful addictions of the mind. All kinds of things. Anything you consider as an obstacle or hindrance. Can you turn it into the path? Can you turn it into the practice? Can you discover where the awakening is in that? As opposed to thinking that you have to get rid of that and get beyond it to be awake. Because when your presence is stronger than what you're present for, in a sense, it doesn't matter what you're present for. So the last thing I'll say, and then I'll give you a chance to ask questions or make comments. Many years ago here, when we first opened up here, I invited down 14 or so of the senior teachers from San Francisco Zen Center to give them a chance to get out of their own place and have a conversation as a group in, you know, an independent, neutral kind of place. Because they spent 30, 40 years together. It's about time they kind of get out of that scene. And it was very nice, and we had a wonderful time. We had a day here together. And we went around the room and asked, had a kind of question for each person to answer, something like, what were your challenges? What challenge do you have with Zen practice? And interesting question for someone who's been teaching for many years and very mature practitioner. And the thing that struck me, and surprised me at the time, but struck me, was as they went around the room, many of them, or most of them, talked about difficulties they had with themselves, with Zen practice, with a variety of things, with their own shortcomings that they had. And rather than kind of feeling that with 40 years of Zen practice they should have no shortcomings and they should kind of like just be like this perfect Buddha, what was so refreshing was how completely at ease and relaxed and accepting they were of talking about their shortcomings and difficulties. It was like their shortcomings and difficulties were like this really light coat that they were wearing that they're quite happy to take off and show you. Look, this is my coat. As opposed to this heavy, you know, wetsuit that just, you know, is so tight, you know, you can't take it off. So, you know, so this kind of being unapologetic, undefensive, you know, not needing to kind of present themselves in some kind of special kind of identity, like I'm a special person. Just, oh, this is who it is, what it is. And the lightness in which they held their difficulties and the freedom in which they talked about them, to me was really refreshing. So enlightenment is found in your delusions. May you discover what your delusions are first. And once you discover what your delusions are, then may you be awakened about them. So now it's your turn. If you have comments or questions or something you'd like to say. Wait, if you can wait for the mic, that's appreciated for other people's sake. The light needs to be on in the bottom. If the light's not on, it's not on. All the way to you.
Hello. So my question is In this path, would you say there is a reason for the obstacles, or would you say that they just are?
If I can ask you, what do you mean by reason?
Like, do they exist to learn something as an opportunity to grow?
Well, one way to answer that question is that if we choose to see them as opportunities to grow, then they exist for that opportunity. Do they inherently exist as challenges for us to grow from? Is that why they're there in the begin with? I don't know. Who knows? So, you know, I don't go around with some kind of metaphysical idea that, you know, the universe is constructed in order to put this person in front of me so that I can deal with this difficult person. And that's the person's, you know, purpose in life is to be cause difficulties to me. You know, just I don't know why the person's there. The person's there. So I'm having a challenge. So let's make the best of it. Let me find the path. And it's really remarkable to me when so many times I've seen people who have chosen to practice with difficulties that have been very, very difficult. And because they're practicing with it, bringing their mindfulness, their honesty, their clarity, trying to find out what it means to be non-reactive in this situation, difficulties that seemed like it should never be, that later they look back and say, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. I was really changed by that. But they had to practice with it. You know, they had to bring something to it. So we have to bring something to it. If we just kind of have difficulties and then say, poor me, and, you know, that doesn't work. So, does that answer your question well enough? Are you satisfied?
Hi. What about something like, let's say you have like a difficult job or something, and you're kind of questioning, well, should I stay with this and deal with this difficulty, or is it best to get out of the job because it's kind of unnecessary suffering?
Right. That's a great question. And if you engage that question really well, you're on the path. You expect me to give you an answer to that question?
Tell me, Gil, what do I do?
I'm glad I satisfied her, because I'm not going to satisfy him, apparently. One out of two is pretty good. So I think it's great you ask the question, and I think you know, explore it in a variety of different ways. You might talk to friends about it as well. And also it's important to look at your values. You know, what is really most valuable for you? You know, where are your values? Is this aligned with your values? And also, to the best of your ability, try to get a sense. Is it reasonable, given who you are, given what the work is, given the support you have from your colleagues or whatever, is it reasonable for you to turn this into a path of practice? Is it reasonable for you to transform it in such a way that it becomes a useful thing for you to hang in there? And if you use your best figuring and say, you know, I don't think this is possible, or this doesn't align with my values, then maybe useful to go some other direction. Another thing to look at in these kinds of questions is the role of fear. How much fear is operating? And maybe there's none, but sometimes to smell out the fear that's in the equation and make it really conscious can help clarify why you're choosing one thing over the other, and help you find more genuine reasons to choose something as opposed to choosing out of fear, whatever direction. There in the back in the corner.
I was going to ask you a question. Can you hear me?
You have to go all the way. You know, I think the red light goes on when it's also in the middle.
The red light is on.
Yeah. There you go.
I was going to ask you a question, but then I think I answered it. I'm going to repeat it.
That's great. You know, my first Zen teacher, it was very hard to get an interview with him. People had interviews maybe once every 6 months. And I don't know if he was rationalizing it or whether it was, you know, he said it was, you know, whatever, but it worked pretty well. And he said the reason was he wanted you to spend a lot of time with your own question.
Yeah,
and,
because...
Because you're better to solve it yourself.
Yeah, because I was thinking about, you know, what you're talking about, turning the obstacles into a path of practice. And when the situation is particularly, well, obviously, when it's really toxic or, you know, the answer, what I came up with is what I heard in the yoga class here, and I hear a lot of things in the yoga class that are so profound that have been helping me tremendously as I apply them to my life. And what she said was, and it's so simple, when the pose is no longer beneficial, get out.
Good.
So that answers my question. As long as I'm learning something from the situation, I continue to remain in it. And then as soon as I stop, then I get out as fast as possible.
Right. So we don't want to be kind of stoic and hang in there. Oh, I'm supposed to find a path in this. You know? And while we're just kind of being ground down to dust. You know, so there has to be some wisdom about exactly what Sophia said about, you know, is this beneficial? But there has to be some realistic assessment of it's beneficial as well. It's very easy to jump to conclusions prematurely or one way or the other. Thank you. Someone else? Please, up here.
If one adopts the concept of two, if you may, plus, minus, good, bad, that kind of approach.
Yeah.
Two. In relationship to the perfect shape, the geometrical shape of the universe, which is an ellipse that has two foci, everything is two, kind of basic concept of two, if we adopt that concept. Then we can say, okay, there is truth and there's falsity. Maybe those are the two that are equivalent to the concept of two. So then we'd say, well, other things would be satellites around those two. And the satellites in falsity would be anger, hatred, other emotions, which are perhaps a delusion and not truth. So is it appropriate to assume that those emotions that we have, anger or hatred or whatnot, are sub-satellites of delusion itself?
I think that there's a lot of emotions which are arise from the core delusions that we have. Yes. Not all emotions arise out of delusions. Some of them arise out of wisdom. And so there are what in Buddhism is called the roots of certain kind of emotions, states, thoughts, reactions. And those roots, some of those roots are defined as delusion and some are defined as wisdom. So there is in Buddhism a tendency towards, in teaching the Buddha, a kind of binary or dichotomous thinking. Like you're talking about two things. And that one of the primary ones is not truth and falsehood, but rather is something like suffering and freedom from suffering, or beneficial or unbeneficial, helpful and unhelpful. Is things helpful or not helpful? And so, and it tends to be, Buddhism tends to be, in a certain kind of way, be forgiving a little bit, or generous as you listen to this word. It tends to be a little bit anthropocentric. So from the point of view of the person who's practicing, as opposed to maybe some other traditions which are more theocentric or more metaphysically centric, some principle of the universe. And Buddhism tends not to go into this metaphysics or into the nature of God and all that. It tends to be more, starts with the principle of the person who's practicing. From that point of view, the polarity of dichotomy between what's helpful and not helpful is pretty basic. Are you satisfied?
Thanks.
Thank you.
So what would be helpful in not grasping after that sense of presence?
Oh, what would be helpful so you don't grasp after that sense of presence?
Yeah. I've noticed that a few times.
Well, one of the things that helps is if you can identify the suffering that comes without grasping. If you really see that, then it's, if you really see, really feel that you have your hand on the hot stove, you probably pull it off. So if you really see that grasping is unsatisfactory, it's painful, it diminishes you in some way, then at some point, if you feel it well enough, know it well enough, you'll probably let go. Okay, so last, thank you. This can be the last one.
One of the things that I've been struggling with is I have a strong compulsion, and I imagine it to have some very strong positives, not just for me, but for those around me as well. And there are certain habits of thought and habits of emotion that that keep that compulsion going. And so I've often thought, is it better to remove myself, to break the habit of thought and emotion, or is it better to just work with it slowly?
I mean, is it better to remove yourself from a situation
right,
where the compulsion might arise, or is it better to work with it? Is that the idea?
Right.
Yeah, so it has a lot, the answer to that question probably has to do more with your sense of what's possible, what the consequences are. So there are some people, it could literally be deadly for them to put themselves in a situation where they're tempted to act compulsively. You're likely to act that way. They're much better off removing themselves entirely from a situation where they're tempted. That's the healthiest thing to do. And other people for whom they see that maybe it's more helpful for them to in a slow way chip away at it, to understand it, to learn how to not be caught by it and become freer from that compulsion. And that creates a more realistic possibility to go into more challenging situations later. And different people, different kinds of compulsions for different kinds of people, different choices are made. Sometimes there's strategic withdrawal, which is useful to withdraw for a while. Regroup, get some self-understanding, develop some strength, some different kinds of strength. And then from that inner strength and inner self-knowledge that's developed, then you can go back in the situation when the compulsion arises and then chip away at it again that way. So there's all kinds of solutions. So without knowing more details about your situation, I think that, you know, I have to answer very generally like that.
Yeah, it's something I've been working with for years, well, about 2 or 3 years, and there is progress, but it's hard to have patience with that slow progress. Very, very, it's hard to have patience for myself through that.
Yeah, it's, you know, and certainly in terms of finding the path, patience is one of the first qualities that you could hopefully develop. If you don't develop patience early on, the path can be pretty frustrating. Because I think it is slow. You know, there are times when it goes really fast, but I think mature spiritual, my sense of a mature spirit approach to spiritual life is one that settles in for the long haul, is patient for it, and just chips away, works away at it. And the whole kind of myth of the Big Bang approach to awakening, you know, just thinking, you know, it's just, you know, we get that Big Bang, and then it's, you know, occasionally there are big things that happen, but I think a much more mature approach is to actually do that slow, patient approach. And I'm fond of the idea that if you take two parallel lines and nudge one of them slightly off from the other, angle from the other one, for the first, you know, mile or 10 miles or whatever, you might not see any difference, but after a year or 2 years or 10 years, they've diverged quite far. So sometimes a very small change in our life today might not seem too consequential right now, but can be hugely consequential because you've changed the direction it's going. So I think, you know, be patient. So anyway, is that satisfying enough for you? I'm not that satisfied, but... So thank you. So... thank you so much, and And as you go about your week this week, you certainly can look for the path in your life, but also maybe you can be inspired a little bit by the fact that there are 25, many people from here, 25 people kind of part of our community now, at Hidden Villa on a silent retreat, doing their walking and sitting practice through the week. And so hopefully their practice supports our practice, and hopefully our practice out here in the world also supports theirs. So thank you.
Thank you.